Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, October 10th, 2022. This is the 25th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I'm joined once again by Christelle Niant, an independent journalist based in Ukraine who maintains the Donbass Insider. All right, Christelle Niant, welcome back to the program. How are you today?
I'm fine, fine. A little work.
Yes, no, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me once again. You were last on in July, where we discussed your background as an independent journalist in Ukraine, the history of the Donbass, and the origins of the current conflict. And I'd really encourage people to go back and listen to that interview in the archives, because you provided a very detailed and thorough analysis of the current situation, of the historical context, and, you know, just like a lot of background information relating to the conflict. And last time we spoke, you were in Ukraine in the Donbass region. Now, apparently, you're actually in Russia following the recent referendum. So that's an interesting development. Yeah.
I'm still in the same region, but the region has changed from officially being considered as a Ukrainian by the Russian authorities until the referendum. And now we are officially in Russia.
Very interesting. And yeah, we're going to get into that in some detail here as we proceed. The first thing I wanted to ask you, it's sort of a broad question, but I'm curious, like, how would you explain the current conflict to an average Westerner? What is the media leaving out of its coverage of Russia's special military operation? What are some of, like, the main points that, you know, an average American or an average, you know, person in the United Kingdom or France or Germany needs to understand about this conflict?
The first thing to understand is that this conflict began in 2014 after a coup d'etat in Kiev, and the people in the Donbass and in Crimea refused the consequences, the result of this coup d'etat. Since then, the Ukrainian army has been shelling the Donbass and the Donbass civilians. There were the Minsk Agreement first in September 2014 and the second in February 2015, which were never respected by Ukraine. They were never implemented. And at the beginning of this year, Ukraine gathered a lot of soldiers, military equipment, and it was obvious that they were preparing to invade the Donbass, to retake the Donbass by the force. And so they have begun to increase the shelling 1 week before Russia decided to recognize the Donetsk and the Lugansk People's Republic and then to finally intervene into the conflict, which was not the case since 2014.
Very good. Very, very concise. Lots of good points. What about the way America and the collective West, what role has America and the collective West played in sort of instigating this conflict and, you know, instigating the Ukrainian government? Yeah.
They have fueled the conflict in various ways. First, the Western guarantors of the Minsk agreements, which were France and Germany, never really put pressure on Kyiv so that they apply the Minsk agreement. So they did nothing to really ensure that a pacific solution can be found to the current war. That's the first point. Since the beginning, the Western media also, and I think it's on orders of the governments, because a lot of them depend on governments, so like in France, for example, a lot of the big media, they touch money from the government. Without that, they cannot live. Subventions, you can say like this. And they have covered all the war crimes of the Ukrainian army, the torture, the systematic torture by the SBU, and all the horrors of Ukraine, they have put that under the carpet. That's the second point. And the third, more direct and really terrible, is that they directly provide weapons to Ukraine, even if they know what Kiev will do with it. I mean, they know since 8 years that Ukraine has absolutely no problem to shell purely civilian areas, purely civilian targets. I remember that it is a violation of the Geneva Convention. It is a war crime. I want to make a difference to explain a bit, because a lot of people are telling me, yeah, but Russia also is killing civilians. Okay, there is a difference between you shell a place where there are military and you unfortunately touch also civilians which are nearby. That's what we call collateral damage, yes? And when you voluntarily, deliberately shell a civilian area where you know there is no military target, then it is a war crime. It is a violation of the Geneva Convention. So since 8 years, Ukrainian army has a list of war crimes which is so long that it's... I think if we put all of them in a list on paper, I mean, we can touch the moon, I think. Despite that, they provide to Ukraine artillery, HIMARS from America. France is providing a lot of artillery stuff, and they want to provide more and more dangerous weapons. And these weapons, they are used to kill civilians by the Ukrainian army. We see a lot of shelling of purely civilian infrastructure with all these Western weapons.
Yep.
So that's how the West is really fueling the conflict in a very, very terrible manner.
Yes, and pretty much everything you just explained has been totally absent in the media's coverage of the current situation, of course.
Yeah, they don't talk about that. They don't talk about the use which is done of these weapons, because they know that if people would understand that their money, because at the end it is their money, because even if officially they sell these weapons to Ukraine, in reality it's paid with all the economic help which is provided by the US and the European Union mainly. So at the end it is your tax money. Okay, it's the tax money of Westerners, so they don't want that Westerners understand that their money is used to provide weapons, which are used to kill the little children and the grandmothers and purely civilian people. I mean, a lot of people, when they discover that, when I found a lot of shells, little shrapnels of shell, and sometimes there are markings or stuff which help to identify. And when people understand that it's coming from their money, really, they get angry, because they say, I don't want my money to be used to kill children or grandmas in the Donbass. I don't want that. So that's why all the Western media are hiding completely all this, because they understand that it would have a very negative impact on the support to Ukraine from the Westerners.
Right. Well, I mean, since the beginning of this special military operation and even leading up to it, the West was basically providing unwavering political and financial support to the regime in Kyiv. And since the war, I mean, I think it's – I don't even know what the figure is now. I think it's over $50 billion that just the United States has spent.
Yeah, what the United States is spending is just – astronomous. I mean,
it's absurd. I mean, it's absurd. And you and an average American, and you know what? Like, I'll even talk to average people in America, and everybody is saying the same thing. Everybody's like, why are we spending all this money on this foreign country that really has nothing to do with us? You know, I mean, people don't understand the history of this.
There are a lot of people who more and more people who now do not understand, because when the first package of, I think it was $47 billion, which was signed by Biden, when it was done, at the same time, it was refused to allocate, I think it's $40 billion to help the small and middle-sized enterprises.
Yes.
And already a lot of politicians said, but what? We give $47 billion for Ukraine, and we refuse $40 billion to help our enterprises. And now there are even more scandal after what happened in Florida, if I don't mistaken, this hurricane, which made a lot of destruction. Some people are complaining that there is no money to repair the houses, to compensate for people who have lost everything in
Oh, Christelle, can you?
Ukraine.
Oh, sorry. You know what? You cut out there for just a moment. You were saying there's no money for the poor people in Florida who have had their lives ruined by this hurricane, but we have unlimited money to send to Ukraine. Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, it's one of the biggest scandals probably in modern American history, and
It's the
it's
same in
just
France.
outrage.
It's the
It's
same in
outrageous.
France. You know, it's the same in France. In France, the French authorities are telling to people how we have to be really careful with the budget. We have to count each euro, you know, for when it's a question about something to help the French, it's, oh, we have to count each euro. And then they say, okay, we will give like 1 billion, and I don't know, 1 billion and 7 or something like that, to Ukraine. And people are, what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is truly absurd. And like I said, it's been going on since the beginning of the conflict, even leading up to it. I mean, the Zelensky regime has been this darling in the eye of the Western media and the Western political establishment, and has basically been used as a proxy in a broader war on Russia. I think that this is really the bigger picture here, is this isn't, yeah.
That's a proxy war. That's a proxy war of NATO. And mainly the US, because it's the United States which are leading this conflict. It's a proxy war of NATO and the US against Russia, using Ukraine as the battlefield and the Ukrainians as the cannon fodder.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly right. And this is something that Putin has recognized from the beginning and has clearly articulated this in many of his speeches, including in the most recent one, which is another topic I want to get to as we proceed here. That was a very, very powerful and truly revolutionary speech, in my opinion.
It
So
was
I, yeah,
very tough
yeah.
speech. It's the first time I'm translating the major speeches of Vladimir Putin in French since a long time, because usually it's not provided on the Kremlin side. They do English translation, but even the English translation is not always really accurate. So I prefer to do mine so that people can really read what he said fully, not just extract, but fully, so that they understand what is in his mind and what he wants to transmit as information. I think it's important to understand his politics.
Yes, absolutely.
And the last speech was really the toughest one I've seen from Vladimir Putin since the last 8 years.
Oh yeah, it was one of the best, most important speeches and that I may have ever heard in my entire lifetime, frankly. I mean, it was that good. And that's something we'll get to. I want to start with the referendums, 'cause these just took place in the Donbass region, which comprises the Donetsk and the Lugansk People's Republics, and these are the two republics that originally declared independence and asked for Russia's assistance against the Ukrainian military and the Zelensky regime in Kyiv back in February, correct? Right. So it was these two regions, these two republics that comprise the Donbass region, along with two, and from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the other two regions are actually, are they oblasts? So like basically like states or counties in Ukraine?
It's like yes, it's like counties. And there were so the two oblasts, the two regions of Kherson and Zaporozhye.
Right, exactly. Now, and if you look at a map, most Americans probably couldn't even find Ukraine on a map anyways, but if you look at a map of Ukraine, you're basically looking at the most southern and eastern territories of Ukraine, right? Yeah. So, to get started, what can you tell us about the history and demographics of these particular areas? Are they largely Russian-speaking peoples?
Largely, all the south and east of Ukraine is mainly Russian speakers. This part was out of the south, which was conquered by Catherine the Great in the 18th century, but the eastern part of what is now Ukraine was conquered by Russia in the 17th century already. So it's one of the part of Ukraine which was the longest time in the Russian Empire. All this part in the east, and then the south and Crimea, it's really the more integrated to Russia part of the country. All these areas were part of the Russian Empire until the revolution of 1917. So yeah, it's mainly people who speak Russian, like in Odessa, like in Donetsk, in Lugansk, in Kherson also. It's really mainly, like in Crimea, mainly Russian speaking people and people who have Russian origins. Honestly, the thing is that, as I already said, when the USSR was created, they just took this territory, decided that it would be Ukraine, and they just changed the nationality of the person on the passport, and that's all. But as I said, you can say that a dog is a cat. It will not say meow. It will not happen, you know. So they have just done that. They tried to Ukrainize people by force, and then they themselves understood that it doesn't work, so they have abandoned that. So, all the east and the south of Ukraine is really the most Russian and Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. So, for me, the results are not... I was not surprised. I was a bit astonished by the score, I think, in the Kherson region, which is really high. Zaporozhye a little bit less, but okay, I can understand. But these referendums were held in very difficult conditions because Ukrainian army was continuing its shelling, especially of Donetsk, of the Lugansk People's Republic. So in the republics, meaning the DPR, it was necessary to do part of the vote, we can say, at distance, so without gathering people at a poll station, because of
right,
course,
yeah. I saw your video.
If there would be a shelling in one of these places, it would have been a massacre, frankly speaking. So we had like mobile poll stations, groups of the Electoral Commission came from house to house with a little poll box, which was sealed, like the biggest one. It's just that they are smaller, so you can carry them like a backpack, like a big bag. And people were allowed to vote from home, so without having to risk their life to vote. And the last day, they opened the poll stations, and people who were not at home because they were working every day and so on, so they could come and vote during this last day. I know there was a lot of critics about the fact that often the people were voting in front of everybody without any secret, but honestly, all the people I followed during 2 hours, one of these team, and the people were not ashamed of telling I vote for Russia, and they even proudly told it. I mean, like at some point there was a woman, and they give them the bulletin, and they say, okay, read carefully to do your choice. And she said, I don't need to read. I know what I want. It's for Russia. What else? And she ticked the box and put the paper quickly, and that was done. So,
they were enthusiastic.
They were enthusiastic. Myself, I mean, I had one of these team in my home. It was the second day of the vote. They arrived really early in the morning, and I voted. Like, I mean, they just turned the head when I was doing the stuff, but I had nothing to hide. I was proud to vote for the integration with Russia, and it was the case of all the people that I've seen when I was following this team during 2 hours. We went to really several. My video is really short because I didn't want people to be annoyed, but to be bored. But in 2 hours, we have, I mean, I think something like 12 to 15 people have voted. And they all voted for Russia, and they did it without even hiding because they were proud of their choice. So
interesting. Yeah, I've been following your coverage of it. And by the way, your website is donbass-insider.com. And you've got a number of articles about the referendum up there, including the video that you mentioned. And you also have an Odyssey channel that I also follow, where you publish your video reports as well. So that's interesting. I'm curious what. So obviously the Donbass republics, they had already declared independence. Russia had already recognized them as independent republics. These other two regions, though, these were administered by Kiev, going back to, as you mentioned, the foundation of the Soviet Union and how they were sort of incorporated into this artificially manufactured modern state of Ukraine, right? So w was the Russian military basically occupying both of these two regions leading up to this referendum? I mean, did they have total control of the territory and sort of the administration of these regions?
They have control of most of the part of the Kherson region. I mean, I think they have the control like over 90%, I think, of the territory. On the Zaporozhye region, it's a bit less. They don't have the control of Zaporozhye, the town of Zaporozhye, which is the main town of this region. But on the territory that they control, they organize the referendum. And that's how they proceeded. And also in Russia. So I know there was, for example, a big fake, like which was circulating on Twitter with a picture about the vote for people of the Zaporozhye region. And we'll say, oh, look, there is only like 36,000 people who voted, and it's a sham election. And in fact, all the people who shared that, most of them, not all, but some Ukrainians even shared this, even if they read Russian. It was written that it was the people who were on the Russian territory. So it's displaced people who moved from this region to the Russian Federation, and for which poll stations were open in the Russian Federation so that they can still vote without having to come back in the region and risking their life, because the Ukrainian army is still shelling also these two regions regularly.
So, like, if they were displaced
If they
from
were
any of these
displaced, yeah,
regions, yeah, they could actually vote in them.
they could all the people from the four regions who were evacuated to Russia, and it's based on their choice, huh? I precise because I'm also reading a lot of shit about, sorry, but really the people who say that they are deported by force, no, we deport nobody. We deport nobody. Each time people had the choice where they wanted to go. People who wanted to go on the Ukrainian side, on the Ukrainian controlled territory, we let them go to the Ukrainian controlled territory. And people who wanted to be displaced in Russia because their area is still really dangerous. I think, for example, Energodar, this town where there is the Zaporozhye nuclear plant. So these people, they choose to move to Russia, and these people, of course, they should have had the right to vote, because it's a huge number of people. A lot of people evacuated for security reasons, so they were able to vote in like usual poll station in Russia, which were open for them. So yeah, all the people who wanted could vote, even on in these regions or in Russia for the people who were displaced.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I know right from the very beginning, as soon as these referendums were announced, and I believe they took place over like 3 or 4 days, depending on the region.
Five, five,
It was okay,
five.
5 days. Yeah, I was gonna say, I know it took place over a period of time, a number of days. They were immediately denounced as sham elections by virtually the entire collective West, including the U.S. and most other European nations. And so their legitimacy was called into question right from the beginning. What can you say, like, how legitimate were they? I mean, you sort of already addressed this, but I'm curious. I mean, were people being coerced into voting? I've seen some coverage of like Patrick Lancaster, for example, in some of your videos, and other independent journalists. And I mean, from what I can tell, I mean, it certainly seems like this was an entirely voluntary process. And people were very enthusiastic about participating
Very,
in this process.
very.
Yeah. So can you just
People
comment on that?
will say that it's a sham election. I mean, there were several polls which were done in these four regions by several sociologic companies in Russia. Some of them are what is called foreign agents, like Levada and so on. So they are not all pro-Putin. And we, even from these sociologic companies, we had like numbers like 90% of people in the Donetsk and Lugansk republics who were for the integration with Russia, and we had over 80 for Kherson and Zaporozhye. So the result of the referendum is really close to what the polls were giving before the referendum took place, honestly.
Right, yeah.
So for me, it's really correlated. And as I said, I went with these groups. They didn't force anybody. I mean, there was a woman that I didn't film because she asked to, but she said, "Sorry, I forgot my passport at work. How can I do?" And so the people explained, "Okay, then either we will come back again tomorrow if you want, or if you want, the last day you can go to the polling station." And they explained all the process gently, and we continued to the second to the next house. So the people were not forced with a gun on the head, or this kind of horror movie that I've read. There was with these groups, every time it's a policeman with them to ensure the security of the poll ballot box, because it's really important that it's not stolen or destroyed or this kind of thing. But I mean, the policeman was always staying at distance, just following at distance the group, so he's sure that there is no provocation and no terrorist attack also on this group, because it could happen. There were some people who were arrested in Mariupol, who managed to build, how to say, like a homemade explosive device.
Oh wow,
And
and these were.
they wanted to do a terrorist attack against one of the polling stations in Mariupol. So it was really a real threat. I have contacts in the security services here, and they told me they were really, really over busy during the referendum, before and during the referendum, to ensure the security, because they told me it's crazy. We have discovered a lot of groups of sabotage who plan to do terrorist attack, to destroy, to put on fire some polling station, or to do like plant a bomb and this kind of thing. So of course there was a policeman who was with these groups, but it was just to ensure the security. And the guy was not with his gun and threatening people, "Go and vote," you know. No, it didn't happen like this. Absolutely not. So people were
Right.
spreading this. It's really disinformation.
Were these elections were they similar, like administered similarly to previous elections in Ukraine? I mean, was this like is this a common type process, or was this something like totally out of the
No,
ordinary?
it's out of ordinary because of the out of ordinary situation. If we didn't have to fear from, I mean, in the places where there was no shelling from the Ukrainian army, like Mariupol, people just went to the polling station. There were a lot of little polling stations which were organized, like in the, how to explain, a lot of flat buildings, no, buildings where there are apartments and so on in the Soviet Union were built in such a way that you have a very, like a park in the middle between the building. Usually you have a park with a place for the children, with trees and vegetation and so on. So it's always built like this, so that it's really nice indeed, for the people, and built for the people. And so often they installed little polling stations in these areas, in these little parks between the buildings, so that people who get out to go to the shop or go to the work, and they see, "Oh, I can go, I can vote." So they did like this to facilitate the voting in these areas. So in Mariupol, there was not this door-to-door. It was done mainly in Donetsk, Makiivka, Yasinovataya, and Gorlovka, which are the main towns who are still on the front line and who are still regularly shelled by the Ukrainian army. Indeed, two people from one of these mobile groups were injured in Gorlovka during a shelling from the Ukrainian army. So it means these people risk their life and their health to protect the voters. So it's an extraordinary way of doing, honestly.
Right. So the way the voting actually took place depended on the security situation in whatever town or region. Yeah, and that makes sense. What exactly was on the referendum? I mean, it was just like one or two questions, right? I mean, what exactly were people being asked to vote for?
So they had on the paper, so written, are you for or against the integration of the Donetsk People's Republic or the Lugansk People's Republic and for the region of the Kherson or Zaporozhye Oblast? As subjects of the Russian Federation, and so they had box with yes, no, da, or no, nine. In Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republic, the bulletin was purely in Russian. In Zaporozhye and Kherson, it was both in Russian and in Ukrainian. It was the bulletin was in both languages, so that there is no discrimination towards the people who are mainly Ukrainian speaking, so that they can understand fully what they are.
Okay, right.
So yeah, so that was the it was really simple. It was really like one big question and yes or no, da, linet.
Okay. So, I'm wondering who was in charge of this overall process, like who oversaw it and sort of like administered it. Was it done like primarily at the very local level, like local councils?
It was done at local level. It was so for the two People's Republic, it was the Central Electoral Commissions that we have since years because we already had elections in the Donetsk and the Lugansk People's Republic. We had already elections for the head of the republic. We had elections for the deputies, for the parliament deputies. We also voted for the once we began to receive the Russian passports. We also voted for several Russian elections, so it was the constitution changes and the Duma election, the last one. So we had already several elections in the two republics, so we already had a commission which is working well. And in the Kherson and Zaporozhye, it was organized by the local administrations which were put in place, and mainly. I've seen that mainly all these electoral commissions, as most of the polling stations are installed into schools, most of the time the people managing it, it's teachers.
Yeah, and that's sort of similar to what you'd expect here in America as well. I mean, usually it's like volunteers that oversee and participate in the overall, you know, in the voting process in general. And a lot of times it's held in community buildings or schools, stuff like that. So it all seems very normal to me anyways, and especially considering the circumstances in some of these regions, you'd have these mobile teams that you sort of explained who would go around and bring the ballot to residents in the area depending on the, you know, the security situation.
And it was good this way of doing for one reason, which was pointed by an Italian observer who is himself invalid. Is in a wheelchair, and he said it's great because the people who are invalid, who cannot go to the polling station because they cannot move and so on, they had a great opportunity to vote without having to ask to organize something really complicated with some volunteers to take this person to the polling station. the polling station came to these people, and yeah, it facilitated a lot the voting of the elderly, people who have difficulties to walk, and so on. So it was also a great opportunity for people who have an handicap to be able to vote.
Yeah. And the results seemed pretty conclusively in favor of joining the Russian Federation. From the reports that I've seen, it was 93% voted in favor of joining Russia in Zaporozhia, and then 87% in Kherson, Lugansk 98%, and then Donetsk 99%.
Yeah.
So obviously pretty overwhelming support for joining Russia.
It's almost 100, but you have seen there are some people who voted against, so you see that we didn't threat people and so on. But yeah, there are very few people now who are for Ukraine. I mean, in 8 years of war, most of the people who wanted to see this region staying in the Ukrainian, under the Ukrainian control, most of the time they just sold their house or their apartment and they fled to Ukraine. So to me, the result is not surprising at all. I mean,
exactly. Yeah, I mean, these people have been through so much over the course of the past 8 years or more. Deliberately suppressed and targeted by the Ukrainian regime, yeah.
Imagine being shelled by what was your government and what was your army during 8 years. I mean, very few people would consider that it's okay to come back to such a country. I mean, and in the people who voted against the integration, perhaps there are some people who just wanted that the DPR and the LPR stay independent, because we had such people. We had, when the polls were done by all these social companies and so on, we had a certain percent of people who just wanted that the DPR and the LPR stay just in independent countries. So perhaps the people who voted against were not all people who were like for Ukraine, you know. So that's also something which has to be taken into account, because the way the question was done, I mean, it could not make the difference between these people.
Right. Very interesting. Well, as you've mentioned, Ukraine continues to shell civilian targets in these regions, even to this day. And this is something that they've been doing for a very long time, as you've explained. And it seems to me that this is a deliberate policy carried out by Ukraine. It's like a form of terrorism against the citizens of eastern Ukraine. And I'm sure, I mean, I'm curious, is that how people interpret this? You know, like as a form of intimidation, you know, to prevent them from going out and participating in this referendum process, which only seemed to backfire. I mean, it almost...
Of course.
Yeah,
of course you don't attract a bee with vinegar, you know. We have such a sentence in French. I really don't understand how they really, or it was like a punishment. I don't know, because if they really thought they could intimidate people after 8 years of war, I mean, all the people I've interviewed after shelling, because there was shelling during these days of referendum, and people told me, it decides me, I will go to vote. I will go to vote, and I will vote for the integration with the Russian Federation, because only like this will stop. So it backfired completely. I mean, if they really thought they could frighten Donbas people, I think really they should pay some good, psychologists and so on to understand how Donbas people work, because they have really understand nothing at all. I mean, it was sure that it would backfire and that it would increase the support of people for the integration to the Russian Federation. As one woman who voted at home told me, she said, I voted for Russia because Russia is the only one which did not betray us.
Right, yep. Well, and now Russia has basically stated explicitly that attacks on these territories going forward would be considered attacks on Russia itself.
Yeah.
How do you see the war changing going forward following these referendums?
So the partial mobilization was launched in Russia. So it's not a total mobilization. Russia is really mobilizing a very small amount of men, and they have limited it to people with military experience mainly. So there were a bit of no errors because some military enrollment offices wanted to do some no to be a bit zealous, you know, and they took everybody, and it made a scandal. And so Putin, that's why he did a speech where he said, no, I said like this criteria should be applied strictly. Don't do a mess, please. So it was solved. The Russian journalist played a very, very strong counterpower role in this situation. And so people who said that there is no freedom of speech in Russia should read Russian journalists, because in Telegram channels they were really critical of they criticized the way the mobilization was done and so on, and they helped solve the problem by transferring the information of, okay, this enrollment office, I received like 10 of reports of mistakes and so on from there, you should solve this, and it was done. So people who were mobilized when it was not they were not fitting the criteria, they were sent back home. So the authorities listened to what the journalists said. So on the contrary of what people think, Russian journalists, even journalists working for state TV channels, even people working for state TV channels, spoke freely, openly about mistakes and so on, even about strategical mistakes, about what happened in the Kharkov region, about what happened in Krasny Liman. And they are really tough, and they are listened. They are listened.
Wow.
What they say is listened at the level of the authorities. And I mean, it's the best proof that there is a huge freedom of speech in Russia.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting to hear because that's how it's supposed to work in, modern Western society where the media actually investigates and attempts to hold the government accountable for their mistakes or for their crimes even. And it seems to be that actually does play out in Russia, unlike the United States and in Western Europe, where the media basically acts as in many cases they basically cover up the crimes of the elite and and refuse to hold them accountable and expose their misdeeds. So it's almost like the opposite.
It's exactly that. It's exactly that. So that when people say it's dictatorship in Russia, read the Telegram channels of Russian journalists. I mean, read people like Slatkov, Vladimir Solovyov, Andrei Rudenko, which is here on the ground. It's a journalist of Russia One, so it's one of the main state channel. And they were really tough. They are really patriotic, and they are really tough, believe me. They are really tough against the mistakes which are done, and they do their job of counterpower. And so really read that. I mean, people who are afraid because they don't speak Russian, if you use Telegram on your phone, you have a function to have auto translate. You can have an auto translation of automatic translation of the posts, so you can understand main of what the person is saying. And really, you will see it's really they are tough. They are really, really tough. I mean, I'm really not that tough, but even me, I did recently an article when I said to the Russian army, this is this and this, you should really work on that and solve that because it's really a big problem. So yeah, I mean, yeah, they do their work, they do their work, they solve this. So there was only a partial mobilization. They are mobilizing only 300,000 men. The full capacity of mobilization of Russia theoretically is 25 millions.
Oh, say that one more time. 25 million were mobilized.
No, that's
Sorry.
the maximum
That's the
capacity of
maximum.
mobilization. Yeah.
Okay,
So
and they
like
own,
Russia is
yeah.
mobilizing like 1% something like that.
Christelle, oh, sorry. You know what? Sorry, you kind of you cut out there for just a moment. Russia is only mobilizing a very, very small percentage of
Oh,
the
very small.
overall
One, a little
potential.
bit more than a little bit more than 1%.
Okay,
A little bit more
gotcha.
than, it's really few. It's really few. So Russia is really doing the maximum to not involve too much forces in that. I know it's criticized a lot, but I understand why. I understand, and I already explained to my readers. It's because the Russian authorities don't want that this operation has a huge impact on the daily life of Russians. Because if you have to mobilize all the country and so on, we see that in the DPR and the LPR, it's also a huge blow to economy because the men that you are sending to the front, who will do their work?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it would be a major disruption of the entire society, of the economy. Yeah.
Of course, we have seen that here. Here, for example, there was a period when it was difficult to find a taxi because most of the taxi were men. And so here, for now, you see that now most of the taxi drivers, it's women, but it took a little bit of time to adapt and so on. And even like this, we still have a lack of taxis. So that's something which has an impact on your economy, on the mood of the people, and so on. So the Russian authorities are really, they know that there are attempts to destabilize the situation internally. We have seen a lot of campaigns of fakes around this mobilization, around the special military operation to try to really to destroy the support of the people for this operation. And so on. They try to destabilize Russia from inside, and they try hard. So the Russian authorities have to manage this really carefully to avoid destabilizing the mood of the population. I think also the retreat from the Kharkov region was planned because they had not enough men to keep this line of defense. But it was a good, how my colleague Alexander Kot said, it was the necessary slap in the face for the society, for the Russian society to understand that we cannot continue the military operation in this like little format, that we really have to expand the number of men and equipment involved because it cannot work this way for now. Because of the huge involvement of the Western countries who provide not only weapons, but we see now that they provide a lot of what is called mercenaries, but from my point of view, it's already not anymore instructors or so on. It's already the next stuff. In the Kharkov region and the area around then now in Krasny Liman, our guys intercepted a lot of radio communications, and they heard a lot of Polish, English speakers, and so on. So all these mercenaries which are sent are disguised Western soldiers. It's most of the time it's people who have a military experience in the NATO armies,
Yeah.
and they are used to coordinate. To coordinate the recent battles, and that's why we have seen a great improvement of the like strategy on the field, because there are all these we can say like I don't know like mercenary curators or I don't know how to say like
We
it's like an officers.
I'd probably refer to them as private military contractors.
Yeah,
And
yeah, yeah, yeah,
usually,
yeah.
yeah, and usually, as you mentioned, they're usually veterans of one of the divisions of the armed forces of the United States, and then they work for private companies. And we saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan. A lot of times these sorts of and they're what they are is they're basically private security companies that are contracted.
But in reality, it's private soldiers. It's like
Yeah, that's
it's
exactly what
private
it
army. It's a
is. Yeah.
private army. So they are using now this. Because they have seen that by themselves, the Ukrainians were not able to do something. So they have done this, and they use all their technological. I had a huge discussion yesterday with one of my Russian colleagues about my article concerning the improvements I proposed for the Russian army. And he told me the thing is that on the other side now they use a lot all the electronic integration maps with they can see where are all their troops because they are all GPS tracked and they can see in real time on this electronic map, and so they can more quickly give the orders than we do. So it's really we see that there was a turning point. This what happened in Kharkov and in Krasny Liman was a turning point. Now the front line has more or less stabilized. Russia is and the Allied forces in general are now advancing again. We have taken several little localities. We have taken back one of the locality in the Krasny Liman region. So it will be retaken. I mean, it will be retaken. The Russia will adapt to this new way of doing.
The Russians retreated leading up to this mobilization in the referendum process, and now they're sort of regrouping. And it seemed like you were basically hinting that they're going to eventually wind up reconquering all the territory.
Of course. Yeah. It's not even, of course it will happen like this. We already see, so today it was announced that three localities nearby Artyomovsk were taken by the Allied forces. One of the locality which is nearby Krasny Liman was already retaken. So the front line is more or less stabilizing. Russian troops have learned from their mistakes. They have really fortified the defense line in the main critical points. So what the journalist said was taken into account. So they are really improving. So and when these men will be ready, the first one are already arriving little by little. So when all these mobilized men will arrive, it will make a big difference, really. And the numerical difference between the Ukrainian forces and ours will be completely turned off.
Gotcha.
So, interesting.
Now, what do you see? I mean, what is the end game here? I mean, do you see other regions eventually holding referendums like this, or like how do you see this playing out? What is a potential outcome? Yeah.
I think yes. I think after the liberation of the rest of the TPR, some villages in the LPR which were taken by the Ukrainian army, Kherson and Zaporozhye, I think first the Russian army will continue to Odessa, so that it can cut completely Ukraine from the all the arrivals of weapons and so on, which are arriving by the sea. And perhaps retake the Kharkov region. I think Russia will not stop until the moment Ukraine sit down at the negotiation table. So, as for the moment, Zelensky doesn't seem to be in such a mood. I think it will continue. But I think this conflict will last for a moment. I think it will depend on the ability of NATO to continue provide weapons, because with what the United States, I really think it's they did that with the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines. I think the European economy will hardly survive the winter.
Right, exactly.
So, even if the US economy will benefit temporarily about the situation by attracting to her some enterprises and some capital, but I think even they will be impacted at the end by all this. I see that already in the United States there are problems with the price of gasoline and so on. The because all the prices are skyrocketing because they are printing money. Okay, you're printing a lot of dollars to give, but at some point you have to provide something, tangible or services or something which is really existing to support this printing of money, and it's not the case. And
right.
I see that already the US are really upset about the decision of the OPEP plus group to reduce the production of the extraction of oil, mainly from Russia and Saudi Arabia. So I think the US also will be hardly and toughly impacted by all the decisions and the sanctions which were taken. Because a lot of countries refuse to ban, like China, like India, who says I will continue to buy Russian oil, and the European country, I don't see how they will manage the winter without the Russian gas. They're already speaking about blackouts, some planned blackouts and so on, even in Switzerland, which is one of the richest countries on the European continent, and even they are speaking about forbidding to people to heat their house more than 19 degrees Celsius and this kind of thing. And it looks crazy. I mean, what we see now in the European Union, there's this kind of restrictions. It's something you have seen in the third world countries. I mean,
yeah. Well, and it's interesting because Putin referred to this in his recent speech announcing the referendum results, and he explicitly called the Nord Stream sabotage. It's really a form of industrial terrorism, I think, is a better way of looking at what happened there. I mean, that's exactly what it was. It was an act of terrorism. Likely, I mean, I don't know if it's been conclusively proven that the United States or NATO or the West in general was behind it, but they were certainly the only ones to benefit from such a development. And what was really interesting to me, really like the smoking gun in all of this, did you see the tweet by that former Polish foreign minister?
Thank you, USA.
Radosław Sikorski.
He deleted it after. The thing is that there were some American ships and so on which were doing, I think it was exercises nearby at the moment, just before, a few days before the explosions occurred near these pipelines. So for me, and when you see cui bono, who is benefiting from this, of course it's the U.S., so
there's nobody else that benefits from this. The Biden administration and the West in general has ludicrously suggested that Russia was behind it. I mean, who in the right mind would buy? Like a total slap in your face.
I don't know. It's stupid. I mean, if Russia wanted to cut the gas, they just had to turn off the tap. That's all.
Because Nord Stream 2 was never even operational because leading up to the completion of Nord Stream 2 was actually right before this special military operation was launched, and Germany put a halt on it. Germany never officially I'm not sure exactly. Like, they never actually integrated it and actually.
They never gave them the license for the exploitation of the pipeline.
Yes, exactly.
And what is really strange too is that this terrorist attack occurred at the moment. A lot of people in Germany were asking for the opening of the Nord Stream 2. Saying, hey guys, stop this shit, open the Nord Stream 2 so that you can receive gas and we can heat our houses normally, that we can our electricity bills get back to normal, so that we can do business as normal, you know. There were really more and more appeals in the German society for the opening and the launching of the exploitation of Nord Stream 2. So, and just at this moment, oh, the pipelines are blown up.
Exactly. Well, from what I understand, and I'm certainly no expert when it comes to this, but from what I understand, the German industrial economy, which is one of the most productive and sophisticated industrial economies in the entire world, it basically relies on Russian energy.
Yeah,
and so it's going to wind up sabotaging their entire industrial base and totally transform and destroy their economy.
Yes, because it's occurring because they have decided in some completely crazy ecological move to close all their nuclear plants. And they even asked to France to do the same and so on. It's completely crazy. And after they are complaining that, oh, we are too much dependent of on Russian gas. But you had the way to not be so dependent. You had nuclear plants which were working well, and you have decided to close them. But if you close them, then you have to use other sources. And sorry, but the solar panels and all these wind stuff, I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, it's not sufficient when you are a highly industrialized country. I mean, and they are in this situation because of their own bad decisions.
And all of this is driven directly by the unipolar world order system dominated by the United States. The United States is behind all of this, and the people and the forces and the groups controlling the U.S. federal government are the ones behind this. And this is something that Putin explained very, very well in the speech, where he basically denounced the collective West, this unipolar world order, the fraudulent rules-based system, and these like neo-colonial policies that render sovereign nation states complete puppets and slaves to this globalist system. He specifically called out Germany and some of these other European countries who are basically slaves to the U.S. And, you know, when you hear him make speeches like this, and some of the earlier speeches that he made, for example, when he announced the initiation of the special military operation and subsequent speeches as well, it really is no wonder that the entire Western political establishment and media establishment hate this man so much, because he just totally exposes and explains exactly what's going on. I mean, again, I said this earlier, this was really, in my mind, a truly revolutionary speech, yet another expert analysis of the Western system from both a historical perspective and from a contemporary standpoint. And I mean, this is something that should be listened to and studied by average citizens across the world to really understand how the world works.
And when people say, oh, it's just propaganda from Putin, if really the European states would really be sovereign, what happened with the Nord Stream should be a very big diplomatic international scandal.
And you notice how it's not even really being discussed much.
No.
I mean, for something like this, such a huge act of industrial terrorism, and it's not even reported on. No, there's no big investigation. There's no outrage, at least at the political level.
Nothing. And even in the media, I mean, they are pushing this story of Russian responsibility to hide the fact that, I mean, it's like when they discovered that Angela Merkel was spied by the U.S., that her phone was listened and so on. Did Germany made a real scandal? No. I mean, if Germany was really a sovereign country, I think the whole diplomatic staff of America in Germany should have come back home. I mean, they spied on one of their allies, what is pretendly allies. I mean, that's where you see that they are not allies. I mean, they are colony. They are a colony. Well, there is no sovereignty. I mean, it's really visible in this situation. I'm pretty sure that it's the U.S. who did that. So the Swedish authorities said, okay, we have done the investigation, and we have the results, but they don't tell the results. Why you don't tell the results? If it was the Russian, you would have said immediately. I mean, so if they don't speak about the results, it means that it's really an embarrassing result. And the result, I think, it's that this is the U.S. And the problem is all these countries are not sovereign countries anymore. They are colonies like the Ukraine.
Yep. The Ukraine and Putin specifically said that in the speech.
Yeah.
He specifically explained this in the speech, that all these European countries are just nothing but puppets and slaves. And they get embarrassed. And I mean, think about that. Like, you're getting spied on and surveilled by your quote-unquote ally. It's a total affront to the concept of a genuine ally.
And now this ally has destroyed your economy, destroyed your ability even for your citizens to heat their home. I mean, in Great Britain, they have said that a lot of people will fall under poverty level and will not be able to pay their energy bills. What will happen? Will we see in the European and the European Union and the European continent in general? Will we see people die of frozen in their house because they are not able to pay for the bill? I mean, think about that one moment. In which kind of country you see that? In which kind of country you see that people are not able to heat their house, put the light on, and so on, because there are problems with energy? Look at Liban and Liban, or these kind of countries who had like tens of years of civil war and so on. That's what you see in these kind of countries.
Can you imagine the chaos? You see them in third world countries. Yeah,
it's really horrible. Because the European countries had a big potential, and that's what the US were afraid of. They were really afraid of this common work between Germany and Russia, because Russia could provide like a low price energy with the gas through these pipelines, and Germany then can make its industry work and so on. So it was really a big competitor for the US. And now they have destroyed the competition, that's all. They have destroyed the competition and they say that these people are their allies. It's not your allies. I mean, it's a pure lie. And the problem is it's the European population, and I think also at the end the American one, who will suffer of all of this because of the inflation, because of the rising cost of energy, and at some point there will be blackouts and problems to heat your house and so on. I mean, it's completely mad. It's completely mad. I mean, a lot of people, I think, in the West never imagined that this kind of thing could happen in their country. And now these countries will face the same kind of problem that countries like perhaps Syria or Lebanon or other states in the Middle East or in Africa are faced with. I mean, it's
all a result of deliberate policies carried out by the political leadership of these countries, of these European countries, and even America.
Yeah.
And it's all designed to, you know, perpetuate and maintain this totally corrupt and unjust unipolar world order, again, that Putin is expertly explaining and highlighting. Have you seen in the aftermath of his speech all of these neocons? I mean, they've been, you know, demonizing and attacking Putin from day one, but they're just outright publishing op-eds saying that Putin has got to go. Now is time for regime change in Russia. Mm-hmm. John Bolton just wrote an op-ed the other day. I mean, this is the mindset of these people. These people are evil.
But these people do not understand. I mean, I remember the speech even of Zelensky, who said that after these referendums and so on, he will never negotiate or discuss with Putin, that he will discuss with the Russian authorities when there is a new president. But guys, Putin is a moderate. If you don't believe me, listen to what other Russian politicians are saying. Listen to what Mr. Zhuganov is saying. It's the head of the Communist Party. He spoke few days ago, I think, at the Duma, when they were discussing the ratification of the integration of these four regions into Russia. And he made a speech which was really harsh and tough, and much tougher even than Vladimir Putin. Listen to Ramzan Kadyrov. People who say that we don't want to discuss, we will wait for the next president. If the next president is the kind of person like Dmitry Medvedev, even Dmitry Medvedev, that all the West thought was more Westerner and more conciliant than Putin, and the guy is now really much tougher, really much tougher. I mean, they make a huge mistake if they really think that get rid of Putin will solve anything, because if they get rid of Putin, what the person who will come after him, it will be a much tougher and much more radical person.
You know, I'm curious. You followed this much more closely than I have, and I'm sure many of our listeners. What are some of these more hardline Russian nationalist types, you said one of them was the head of the Communist Party, I think. What are like these hardliners saying about the situation?
Kadyrov, for example, is for making an assault on Kyiv and capturing Zelensky and make him sign the guy is really like, okay, stop this stuff, really shell Kyiv like hell and go, and we take the town, and that's all. Kadyrov has his own Telegram channel again. I really encourage people, go on Telegram, find Kadyrov. It's Kadyrov_95. That's the name of the channel. It's his official channel. He maintains himself. He's posting a lot of videos done with his phone on this stuff. And there are a lot of text which can be translated with this automatic translator. And really, I mean, listen to him. I mean,
much more hardcore than Putin.
The communists, they are for the total mobilization. Like, okay, we mobilize millions of people and we just take the whole Ukraine and that's all. I mean, they are really much more radical people who want, like, to go until Wolf. I mean, so people would think we will get rid of... I mean, as Putin said in his speech, I mean, in the West, they are like openly dreaming, publicly dreaming about dismantling Russia. I mean, what the heck? But who gave you the power to decide for Russians how it should be cut in several little parts? And so what? I mean, it's really, I mean, they are not hiding and it's done openly. You can find, if our audience type in your favorite search engine, decolonization Russia, and you will find articles in English speaking about the need to split Russia in a lot of little states, and they dream openly about that. And Russia, and now, why is Putin told that in his speech? To make people understand that the mobilization is not like some crazy stuff, that now it's really a question about Russia win this war or Russia will not survive. Because just have a look at all these decolonization plans, all these dismantling plans, that's what it's... he said, we have to win this war. If it's not, then have a look at what they have already planned for us. So... that's really
well. I think that the Russians have always recognized that this conflict is more than about Ukraine. It's more than about the Donbass. Yeah. This is a broader geopolitical conflict.
But now that the West is really publicly speaking about this decolonization plan, I mean, it's frightening. I mean, you have a look at that, and Russians are what?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, and so it's really important in. I really think that now we have seen a turning point, and it will take, of course, a few weeks to integrate all these mobilized guys. They are now under huge training to, adapt. They are trained by people who have been on the front line here, so who have fought here during the military special operation. So they are trained by people who have the experience of what is really happening on the field. So it's a good thing. I think it will go gradually. So I think there is this first mobilization. There is also a huge campaign of recruitment of Wagner. So this military private company, which is owned by the oligarch Evgeny Prigozhin, and they are really pushing for that, so that it's mainly volunteer people. So that it's and during the mobilization, a lot of volunteers applied, and first they were refused, and then Putin said, "Why you refuse these guys? Take them. They want to fight. Take them. No problem. Okay, they will need a bit more training, perhaps, that some guys with the criteria that we set up at the beginning, but okay, take them." So there were like dozens of thousands of volunteers inside the people that they have gathered during the mobilization. So it's not something which is like anecdotic. It's really, and it pushed people when they saw the situation. They say, okay, they need fighters. I go. So, and I think it will go increasingly. So I think it will go step by step. And the West, which is calling for departure of Putin, I mean, I want to laugh. Because
yeah.
if the next president is Dmitry Medvedev or Ramzan Kadyrov, oh, guys, you will cry. You will cry like babies. Because, I mean, these men are really, I mean, Kadyrov, I think it's Kadyrov who said that if it was him who was deciding, he would already have sent a nuke on Kiev. I mean, no, really, people who really think that it would be better without Putin, no, guys, really. Listen to Russian politicians, you will discover that Putin is really a moderate and very patient man. Really patient.
Right, yeah. Well, Christelle, thank you very much. I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up. That was a great conversation. Yeah, thank you very much for all of your hard work and for taking the time to speak with us and provide some insights into what is really going on in former Ukrainian territory, now Russian territory, where you're currently at.
Yeah.
Your website is Donbass Insider. That's donbass-insider.com. And yeah, keep up the good work. We'll stay in touch, and we'll have to do this again maybe in the next month or two as more developments unfold.
With pleasure.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.